The date is September 27, 1983. This is the fourth lecture in a series of lectures by Roger Weir on the Enlightenment. Tonight's lecture is entitled Vico, that's spelled V-I-C-O, who lived 1668 to 1774, the little-known mastermind of the New World View.
Well, tonight we plunge into the Enlightenment and our person for this evening is one of the strangest madmen of history. Vico is usually thought of as the isolated, errant, half-crazed genius who was all but forgotten for centuries and rediscovered in the 20th century. But actually, Vico is appropriate for us to take because in a very real way, Vico is one of the few minds at the time to be able to move forward from the matrix that Leibniz and Newton had established. And with Vico, we have for the very first time in human history the development of a philosophy of history. In fact, Vico will write and revise over many decades a new science. And this new science is the science of civilization. And so, hundreds of years before the study of civilization will have in fact become a study course in the 20th century, centuries before the 19th century historians will move toward it, there was, at the very beginnings of the Enlightenment, a madman genius, a mastermind, named Giambattista Vico, who formulated the first philosophy of history. At the same time as Vico was developing this, another man, coming somewhat later, about 20 years later in terms of birth, a Frenchman by the name of Montesquieu, will also lay down speculations that will be the origins of the philosophy of civilization. We will mention Montesquieu for the next four or five sessions, so I do not position him as a topic of any one evening, but we'll have to carry him over several sessions. In fact, Montesquieu will become increasingly important as we move from next week, the Comte de Saint-Germain, all the way through until we get to Gibbon, because it was Montesquieu who pointed in the Enlightenment to the fact that understanding the Romans was essential in understanding the European mind. And this is quite startling for us because it was Vico who originally made the diagnosis that understanding the Roman Empire, its development, was the number one intellectual task if there was to be a European maturing of the mind. And in fact, Vico had two great writers of antiquity that he admired. One was Plato, because he felt that the Greek poetic origins found their mythic indelibility in Plato's writings. And the second great writer was a Roman historian named Tacitus, whom he felt had exemplified the best of humane civilization. Now, Vico was born in 1668. He was born in Naples. He was the son of a bookseller. And he was one of those precocious youngsters that we have run into from time to time in our lectures. But Vico had a little bit of an accident, a fall, and he recounts in his own autobiography, which he meticulously wrote and rewrote so that it would seem that none of the events that had happened to him were simply commonplace, natural events, but were in fact prophetic, signed events full of symbolic significance. Vico's great autobiography is in fact a tour de force of a man consciously reshaping his life by reinterpreting it in terms of a very large mythic and symbolic pattern. Vico's autobiography, in fact, is the first great prototype, which we will see again when we come to Jean-Jacques Rousseau and his Confessions, the idea that a man literally with a raised consciousness may refashion himself. But for Vico, because he was not only one of the first, but one of the greatest minds to perceive these possibilities of creation, of making something which in all initial respects might just be fictive, but in fact might be transposed to the realm of the real, Vico himself was very, very cautious about his subject matter. He came upon his background in a very odd way. He was given private tutorials from a very early age, but constantly ingratiated himself with his teachers so that there was a succession of tutors who were dismissed by the youngster. And when Vico reached the ripe age of 18, he was hired to be the private tutor for a castle school, Valotta, somewhat south of Salerno, not too far from Naples, actually. But he went there and for 9 years was the tutor for a royal family there. And it was incumbent upon him to teach the basics to the students, and so he read indiscriminately and voraciously and was teaching all the while for this 9-year stint. He, in his autobiography, refashions this as a period of religious exile, and in this exile had the prophetic powers tuned and raised to an almost universal level. That Vico, in his autobiography, says that in this period, like all great messianic figures in history, I learned to see with the penetrating symbolic vision of the eternal pattern of life. Vico, at this time, found not only Plato and Tacitus as heroes, but discovered the writings of Sir Francis Bacon. And Bacon, especially in his De Augmentis Scientiarum, impressed Vico with the notion that a man might master his mind to the extent that he would not only know the sciences of the past, but could envision the new sciences which were to be discovered in the gaps of human knowledge. And Vico became a hero worshiper and put Plato and Tacitus and Bacon upon pedestals before his mind, and in his visionary way felt that he had been chosen by history and circumstance to take the cue given by Bacon and to advance it by creating the new science of a philosophy of civilization, a history of civilization, that there had never been such a thing before him. And so Vico left the tutorial condition which he had been in. He was now 27 years old. He moved back to Naples. He searched around for some position that he could support himself by. And in 1699, he was given the chair of rhetoric at the University of Naples. Now the stipend that went with this chair of rhetoric was only 100 scudi, not very much, almost a pittance. He also got himself married at the time and progressively had 8 children. So in order to support himself and his growing family and his wife and all these intellectual dreams that he was building for himself, these ambitions and visions, he began to farm himself out for papers and lectures and so forth. And it wasn't until 1735 that Vico was actually recognized and given a royal stipend and created at that time really financial security for himself. For the next 9 years of his life, though, having been given this confirmation of his intellectual prowess, Vico's mind began actually to wander. And in periods of great lucidity, he would revise his works and wrote new ones, but increasingly, he was unable to focus himself. And in January of 1744, he died amidst great Italian turmoil. People argued over whether he was actually to be buried with great honors or whether to be relegated to an ignominious grave. And so Vico, at the end of his life, caused great consternation. The difficulty with his writings is that Vico was almost self-educated from scratch. And so you find, twirled in his great learning, the most trivial redundancies, the putting together of fragmentary, as Stefan Heller would say, balderdash, right next to ingenious insights that were so penetrating that until the 20th century, we had no idea of some of the profundity of Vico's thought. One of the great historiographers of the 20th century, Isaiah Berlin, has written a beautiful volume called Vico and Herder. Herder lived from 1744 to 1805 and carried on some of Vico's ideas. But it's subtitled Two Studies in the History of Ideas. And this is how he characterizes Vico's thought in a sentence or two. In reading Vico, it is constantly necessary to sift the chaff from the grain. This is not an easy task. All his philosophical works and the Scienza Nuova, the new science, in particular, are an amalgam of sense and nonsense, an ill-assorted mass of ideas, some lucid and arresting, others shapeless or obscure, bold and novel thoughts cluttered with trivial fragments of a dead scholastic tradition, all jostling each other in the chaos of his astonishingly fertile but badly ordered and overburdened mind. He is at once obsessed by a single vision of mankind and its history, strictly obeying laws of social development which he is the first to discover, and overwhelmed by too much detail, too many implications of the central thesis, large and small, clamoring for expression at the same time. And so, of Vico, one could say what Ezra Pound said of James Joyce, who was immensely influenced by Vico, that he was a genius who was simply electrocuted by divine fire. Vico began by covering his religious Catholic background, shielding it from the brilliancy of his coming insights by saying that the history of the Hebraic peoples was divine and separate from the development of all other peoples, that they were a special case. He was not going to get involved in scriptural divine history, but that on the other hand, all other peoples were living in a history which had a cyclic shape which was man-made and not God-made. Therefore, He was interested only in defining and tracing with meticulous care the science of history of the Gentiles. And who were the Gentiles? They were the Egyptians, the Chaldeans, the Greeks, the Romans, the Spanish, the Italians, the French. Vico, in his work, very careful to emphasize in the preface to the second edition of the New Science of 1730, Giambattista Vico to the reader writes to us and says to us, "Let us conclude finally with the following few words of advice to any young reader who may wish to profit from this science. Firstly, its work is entirely metaphysical and abstract in conception. Hence, it is necessary in reading it to divest yourself of everything corporeal and of everything to which this gives rise in pure mind, and therefore for a while to put the imagination to sleep and lull the memory." So Vico is saying, I'm going to talk to you in terms of pure reason. This is a science. This is not speculation. Therefore, I want you to put your imagination to sleep. Don't bring it up. Your memory and all these other capacities which you think you have, you do not have. You're going to distort everything I say unless you can put yourself into a position of pure mentation. And of course, the key to the Enlightenment was that the mind of man was the golden key. Vico goes on and he says, of imagination and memory, "For if these faculties are aroused, the mind is unable to reduce itself to a state of pure understanding." So almost by a century, Vico anticipates the great Kantian philosophy of pure reason. He says, if these faculties of the mind, imagination and memory and habit and association and everything, are aroused, you'll never be able to think clearly. He's saying, I have something new here, and it is a science. So he says, "The mind is unable to reduce itself to a state of pure understanding, unshaped by any particular form, and as a result, you will be quite unable to arouse in it the form of this science, and for your sins, you will fail to understand it." We're being told, for the first time in Western history, that in order to understand, we're going to have to clear our mind of all the wreckage, all the verbiage, all the association. Who has told us this before Vico? Descartes. But Vico takes umbrage at Descartes. How dare he try to convince us by giving us lessons in geometric construction that thereby he has actually given us an understanding of the mind which is transferable to the real. He is giving us an exercise in ordered imagination. That Descartes' geometry is a wonderfully wrought imaginative construct which has no bearing upon the real, and therefore unworthy of our inspection. That in fact, he's saying, secondly, the mind in its reasoning is conducted in accordance with a strict geometric method by means of which it passes from each truth to its immediate truth and thus produces conclusions. So he's saying, I have a new geometry of the mind here, but it is not based upon abstractions which are molded by imagination. I have something which is true and truthful. I have a geometry of history. Pythagoras, in one of his fragments, said, geometria is historia. And Vico very much emphasizing this quality, that if you talk about points and lines and planes and angles, you'll have a wonderful, fictive, imaginative universe to play with that has no veracity. He says, I am going to give to man, for the first time, a geometry of veracity to show you the structure of history, because it is in the program of the development of man's history that we are able, finally, to understand reality. And in fact, not only reality, but the very structure of the mind. Because the mind plays itself out for real, not in the exercise books of geometry and so forth, but on the plane of history. We actually make it happen, and it happens from man's mind, which has, of course, certain principles operating in it, which were given by God, but the divine does not constantly interfere in miraculous ways in nature, but works purely because of natural law. And once laid down, then those structures continue to operate. And while in nature, natural law is unsullied and operates exactly in a truthful way, man, because of his conditional nature, sullies natural law and changes and transposes it. Therefore, understanding history is understanding man's bending of nature according to the laws of his mind and the purposes of his mind. Now, this is where Vico, to almost every critic, becomes rather shrill in his diagnosis. He will go on to say that after the great flood, at the very beginnings of primeval man, primordial man, after Noah had begun founding the regular Hebrew line of development, the Gentiles came because the sons of Noah went out and married other human beings who were wild, and that out of this came a race of giants. And these titans, these giants, were the first Gentile human beings, and they were barbaric, to say the least, to say the very least. They were consumed with lust. They would, in fact, and Vico makes a great deal out of this, mate and copulate on the spot at any time that they possibly could, and driven by an insatiable lust within, were only corralled because there would come from time to time great storms from heaven in which the sky gods with their lightning and thunder would terrify these titans who had no way to understand this. And so, and this is the way Vico writes, suspended in between unbearable lust and incomprehensible lightning, the primitive titanic Gentile humanity would flee to caves to hide, and in these caves would get their first lessons in religion. That perhaps it was better, instead of having so many different women, it was better for a man to live with one woman. Instead of roving in bands or individually, it would be better to stay in certain areas, and in these areas to cultivate land, thereby being able to feed themselves, and also because staying with the same woman, they were able then to have a patrimony where the father knew who their children were and the children knew who the father was, and that the beginnings of religion and marriage and thirdly, the burial customs became then solidified, and civilization began from this gestalt, that the three primordial functions of civilization, religion, marriage, and burial, came into Genesis at the same time from this chaotic, barbaric beginning. Very, very important to Vico because he's going to be tracing everything in a flow chart. Everything is going to develop from this. And it's going to develop in threes. There are always going to be three primordial, this, that,
and the other,
carrying all the way through. At this stage of civilization, Vico says, everything was influenced by divinity,
so
that man's mind, and we have to understand he's talking about the Gentile mind, man's mind responded poetically to this situation, would be given inspiration, and so the primordial quality of early divine man was in the great poetic expressions of the unity of religious and marital and burial civilization. And he uses as his example the mind of Homer. And Vico will say that there was not a Homer, but that every village, every town in ancient archaic Greece had a Homer. Because Homer is a stage of civilization leading man from the divine to the heroic. And so that there is a stage of Homers where man goes from the divine inspiration, where he's still filled with terror at the heavens and still filled with incommensurate longings and desires at the earth level, to the heroic, where he begins to try and balance them, that the celestial and the earthy come into a more or less titanic struggle of balance in the heroic age. Then he says there is, following the second age, a third age where man becomes humanized, where the civil qualities of man are stressed, where in fact man becomes occult, because the occult capacities of man come after the balance is achieved between the extremes of heaven and earth, that in this balance the heroic becomes the human, and that the trail then leads from the Homeric epics through to the development of law, and that by tracing the development of law from the early 12 tables at the beginning of Roman history, all the way through to the great codifications of Justinian and so forth, we have the stages of man becoming humanized, civilized, and not only civilized, but interiorized, so that his mind begins to comprehend what it is that he is doing. And so man, according to Vico, has a career much like what we are familiar with in our own times and Jung's psychology of individuation, that man becomes increasingly conscious of what he is doing and why, and interiorizes this to the point where he becomes suddenly self-conscious of the total meaning and pattern of history. And Vico says, I am that first man who has understood why we are here and how we got here, step by step, stage by stage, and I can spell it out to the point that it is a science. That in fact, the development of history is man becoming conscious of the pattern of his wholeness. And as this consciousness becomes filled out and integrated, man becomes an occult being. He becomes metaphysical in the extreme. But just as there was a vicissitude operating at the beginning of civilization, he says, for want of a better term, initially we can just call it a divine sentiment, the sentiment that man will seek to try and put together and will try to balance out. And that progressively, as man entered into the heroic stage, what controlled human society was aristocratic families. he will in fact go back and use all kinds of fantastic examples by saying there probably was some cave personages who were very strong and they had very secure families, and others came to them for protection, and this was the beginning of the larger family and the extension, and so that aristocratic families like the Julii clan in Roman history, by the time you get to Augustus, their families include the empire. But at the same time as the aristocratic families gain hegemony, and you see Vico is the first sociologist of knowledge also, as the aristocratic families gain hegemony, the plebeian families also begin to recognize that this is a source of higher integration, higher power, and they begin to imitate the structure of these aristocratic families. They have associations and institutions, they begin to educate themselves, and there comes a time of a great clash between the patricians and the plebeians. Vico, of course, leaning very, very heavily on his understanding of Roman history, saying that the career of Roman history is a paradigm of human history, and we can understand this, and that there comes a time where the degeneracy of the aristocratic government is finally superseded by the influx of democracies. He says, if we look at Tacitus and the histories and the annals, we see in the time of Nero and Caligula the complete dismemberment of any ethical efficacy to the aristocratic family's right to rule, that history has changed into a new phase, and that with the development of democracies, the humanizing effort comes into focus, so that the sense of humanity and consciousness is exactly commensurate with the development of the democracies. In Italian, consciousness is coscienza, which is a co before science, scienza. So conscience is actually con science, with science. And Vico's saying this is no small thing, that language contains all of this information in its very structure and development. In fact, he will say that language, myth, and art are the three great areas where we most poignantly experience the development to its apex, and that in language, myth, and art, man has a chance to become fully conscious. And so he says, in our time, in Italy, we are on the verge of coming to this fullness, this blossom, that the Enlightenment is, in fact, man becoming raised to his penultimate level. And penultimate because as soon as this happens, as soon as the democratic interiorization of consciousness raises itself to a fullness, there begins to set in a counterbalance of increasing barbarity, that increasingly this becomes unstable and man falls back into a barbarous chaos and starts the pattern all over again. So Vico is the first to say that history is a cycle, again and again and again. That in fact the Middle Ages were somewhat similar to ancient Greece, and that the development of the Roman Empire saw the development of Europe in the same way. And he's saying we are now at about the same point with the development of the democracies beginning, where man is going to be increasingly conscious, interiorized, sensitive to language, sensitive to art, sensitive to mythology, and that when he refines himself to the fine point of achievement, he will already begin to slip back into the barbarism, back to the chaos, back to the realm of lust and lightning dominating his background. Well, you can see that Vico was unbelievably ahead of his time, and yet most poignantly of his time. He is a peculiar cross between the Enlightenment and the 20th century. He says in here that, to the reader, he says, it is necessary that you should have acquired the habit of reasoning geometrically, and that you should neither open these books in any arbitrary place in order to read them, nor dip into them here and there, but follow their teaching from start to finish. And you must consider whether its premises are true and well arranged, but not be surprised if almost all of its conclusions are a source of wonder, something which often happens in geometry, as for instance in the case of two parallel lines which converge ad infinitum but never meet. For its conclusions are affected by the imagination, but the premises hold fast to pure abstract reason. But Vico will claim also that he's not just working with the principles of abstract reason, but something even more forceful. And one of the great codifications in his writing was the little rule of thumb, verum ipsum, that truth manufactures datum, that truth creates the fact. Truth creates the fact that man, by having lived this geometry of history, creates the truthful, factual aspect of this, and this raises it up above even the level of mathematics. Now, this whole concern of Vico with mathematics brings us around to the interesting crisscross and parallel, because Vico certainly knew of Leibniz. You see, Bacon, who had been a favorite of Vico because he had synthesized the old and the new, and one aspect of Bacon's thought that Leibniz developed, and Newton also, was the idea of a universal language, the calculus and so forth, but also the idea that mathematical expression in truth could be something that man could in fact hold up experimentally and jostle in an experimental mode, so that mathematics was in fact an experimental science expressly created by man's mind to explore the possibilities and potential of reality. That mathematical truths were not necessarily real, but that they could be transposed to the real. In a great symposium that was held at Johns Hopkins University about 15 years ago or so, it's called Vico, an International Symposium, about 700 pages of articles on Vico. In the one on Vico and mathematics, we have this kind of a statement made. Starting from the latter aspect of what Descartes had called mathesis universalis, Vico thought that the radical assimilation of physics to mathematics was inadmissible. You could not bring physics to mathematics. You could not assimilate physics to mathematics. But you could go the other way around. You could not force the world to fit into a mathematical mode, because mathematics was like geometrical thinking. It had a certain logical structure to it, which was characteristic of the mind, but that mental validity had no guarantee of soundness. It didn't necessarily become real. It didn't necessarily apply to the world. But if one had a mathematical structure, which was understood in terms of some real developing phenomenon, like history, then you had all the great power and certainty of mathematics, the validity of its form, plus the soundness of its definite applicability. And therefore, Vico was saying, I have come to the point where man not only has a new science, but the new science. This is the science, he says, which will give us universal comprehension for the first time. He says, as Vico says, we demonstrate geometrical propositions inasmuch as we can create them. If we could, therefore, demonstrate the phenomenon of physics, we would have the capacity to create them. But the archetypes, the forms of created things with which their natures comply, exist only in the mind of God. You see, Vico, one of his heroes, was Plato, very, very much a Platonist. The essential archetypal forms exist, but they exist in the mind of God, not in the mind of man. But man now has mathematical archetypes which do exist in his mind. And with this new science, he will have a way of linking them up with the verifiable, real field of history. And therefore, man's mind can finally be brought into play in terms of its powerful organizing structure. Not just to play games. He said Descartes is a wonderful game player. He says, I am a scientist appointed at this time in history to lead us into light. You begin to see something about Vico. He says here, Vico takes a notable different position in regard to the theory of metaphysical points. And this is one of the most perplexing aspects of his thought. The term metaphysical points, and you see every point in geometry is a metaphysical, it has no size. The term metaphysical points is not in itself alarming. It represents merely an evident Leibnizian reminiscence. We know that initially Leibniz used that expression in order to denote what he later preferred to call by the more fortunate name of monad. Nor should we be worried about the fact that Vico rebaptizes the Leibnizian points as Zenonian. Zeno was a great Greek philosopher in antiquity who was capable of expounding a paradox. So Vico, in his mind, he's trying to be precise, he's saying, Leibniz is not discovering this. This is a part of the evolution of the cycle of history, and Leibniz merely did exactly what Zeno did in that cycle. So we're about in the same place, and here's a good confirmation. You can almost check your historical watch and say it's now about time for such and such a phase to come in. So he says, I'm not going to call these Leibnizian. These are Zenonian.